Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We are going to finish chapter 2 of Zephaniah. And as you know, in the middle of Zephaniah, we've got the countries that are surrounding or involved with Judah at this time being mentioned in prophecy as far as their destruction. The Philistines in chapter 2, verse 4, Moab and Ammon in chapter 2, verse 8. One verse about Cush, which is basically Egypt, or at least southern Israel, or what is called Upper Egypt, or the last line of Cushite kings or pharaohs in Egypt in verse 12. And that apparently had already occurred just a few years before in 663, but it was like the final blow, probably why it's only got one verse. They will be slain. I mean, they're never going to come back. The Cushites are never going to come back and rule Egypt. After, we saw last week, after the Cushites fall in 663, there's one more dynasty of Egyptian kings coming from the north or from lower Egypt that worked with the Assyrians. In fact, were trained in Nineveh and then put in place. And then after them, the Assyrians are going to be defeated by the Persians, and the Persians will take over. The Persians fall to the Greeks, and the Greeks take over. And when I say take over, meaning they take over Egypt. And then, you know, Cambyses becomes the pharaoh of Egypt, or the king of Egypt, ruling from the Persian Empire. Then the Greeks take over, and you're going to have the Ptolemies, which leads to Cleopatra. And there's never again what we'd know as the Cushites or the native pharaohs ruling. So that verse we looked at last week, chapter 2, verse 12, is, again, referring to the last dynasty, the Cushites, having already ended with the fall when Ashurbanipal took it, but then after them, they're never coming back. And now we begin in chapter 2, verse 13, 14, and 15, talking to the Assyrians, which were the world power. I'll read it right here. Now, the first chapter talks to Judah, talking about their judgment is sure. Then there's a brief moment of saying in chapter 2, verse 1 through 4 of basically prepare your souls, seek the Lord. Perhaps you'll be sheltered, not in a sense protected physically, but you'll have some kind of strength in the Lord while your country's falling apart. And then he talks around the surrounding cities to the west, the Philistines, to the east, Ammon and Moab, to the south, the Cushites, or Egypt, and then now to the north, the great power, the Assyrians. And then chapter 3, verse 1, it starts off in chapter 3, verse 1, woe to the city of oppressors, rebellious and defiled. She obeys no one. She accepts no correction. And goes on and talks. It's like, you wonder, is that continuing to talk about Nineveh? That's a clear switch now going back to Jerusalem for the final chapter. It's going to identify that fourth generation of Israel or Judah in Jerusalem. And then the book ends with some kind of a promise about what will take place in the future. Even the last verse talking about, I will give you honor and praise among the peoples of the earth when I restore your fortunes before your eyes, says the Lord. So as in all the minor prophets or the major prophets, all the prophets, when they announce judgment, they do not take their eye off the covenant of Abraham and look to the future of the restoration of the people. So no matter how bad it looks in the day of Zephaniah, there is the promise of the future. So we're going to look right now at verses 13, 14, and 15 of chapter 2 of Zephaniah. I'm just going to read straight through it out of the NIV. Then we'll look at it in the English Standard Version. Here it is. He will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria, leaving Nineveh utterly desolate and dry as the desert. Flocks and herds will lie down there, creatures of every kind. The desert owl and the screech owl will roost on her columns. Their calls will echo through the windows. Rubble will be in the doorways. The beam of the cedar will be exposed, or the beams of the cedar will be exposed. This is the carefree city that lived in safety. She said to herself, I am, and there is none besides me. What a ruin she has become, a lair for wild beasts. All who pass by her scoff and shake their fists. That's the NIV. I'm going to read right off the notes now, the bold print, the English Standard Version. You can hear some differences in here. Again, as they're struggling to translate into English, chapter 2, verse 13. And he will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria, and he will make Nineveh a desolation, a dry waste like the desert. Verse 14, herds shall lie down in her midst, all kinds of beasts, even the owl and the hedgehog shall lodge in her capitals. A voice shall hoot in the window. Devastation will be on the threshold, for her cedar work will be laid bare. Verse 15, this is the exultant city that lived securely, that said in her heart, I am, and there is no one else. What a desolation she has become, a lyre for wild beasts. Everyone who passes by her hisses and shakes his fist. So again, that's describing their condition, the prophecy, how great they are, how great they think they are. And that word, you know, we'll get to it, but that phrase, I am and there is no one else, you can hear in there, I am, referring to self-sufficiency. I take care of myself. I'm self-sufficient. And there is no one else, meaning among the nations and the cities, there's nowhere else to get the protection, the economy, the culture. We are it. We are the center of the economy. We are the center of protection. We are the center of culture. And we are self-sufficient. And we'll look at that. You can see that is how Babylon describes herself in Isaiah. Also, we saw that last night when we mentioned Laodicea, that we have all that we need. It's that idea that you rise so high that you begin to realize you are self-sufficient. You can take care of yourself. You have so much money, so much power, so many resources that all the other dependents, if they be cities or nations, are relying on you to hold the economy together. And it is even in that place that God is saying, when I'm done with you, there's going to be animals living where you live, occupying your territory. Actually, a reversal of the creation order. The creation order was man was created to have dominion over the earth and over the animals. And now, if it be Nineveh in tonight's verses, or Babylon in Isaiah, or Laodicea in Revelation chapter 3, man has risen to a place, if it be in an empire, if it be a city, if it be in the church, that we're self-sufficient. We have all we need. Everyone depends on us. And God says, well, once you become arrogant, I'll just flip that around, put you at the bottom, and even the animals will occupy your space, and you'll be forgotten. So it's just, I mean, that's a very humbling thing. And it's something that you almost have to wrap up into your worldview and remind yourself, because if it be in your own life, you know, especially when you're vibrant and young, or if you're wealthy and independent, if you're a nation with all kinds of power and control and resources, and you can order and push buttons and create things, you kind of begin to think, you know, we are self-sufficient. We have solved all of our problems. Or you realize that others are depending on you. And that is, again, man's position. We talk about that on Sunday mornings. God made man to have dominion. Everything is subject to man. That is man's rightful place. But man has fallen, and in a fallen state, even creation continues to have dominion over him. But it is only in Jesus Christ that man is going to reach that fulfillment. So there is going to be a day where man will be able to say, you know, in their position, they are self-sufficient as man, and everything revolves around them, but that is only going to be fulfilled truly and sustainably in Christ, who is the man, who is self-sufficient, and everything revolves around him. So, like Hebrews says, we do not see everything yet subject to man, but we see Jesus. And someday, when the man Jesus returns and sets up his kingdom, man will, through God, through Jesus Christ himself being a man, Jesus himself and the resurrected saints, believers, will reach the full potential of mankind at that time. But here we have Assyria, or Nineveh, referring to Babylon, referring to Laodicea, trying to be that place. But actually, it appears, and again, the warning for us would be, we can get to a place where it looks like we have so much power, it's going to be hard to bring us down. And yet God says, this is being spoken, recorded by Zephaniah sometime, I think probably 6:17, we've got right in here. as early as 624, or I'll say 623, this would probably be the time it is being recorded. It's during the days, clearly, during the days of Josiah, 640 to 609. Nineveh is going to fall in 612, so it has to take place before 612. So that would mean these words are being spoken 5 years before the fall of Nineveh, or we could say 9 years, 9 to 5 years before the fall of Nineveh, these words are being spoken about Nineveh. Now, the empire has gone into decline. Everybody's kind of retreating back into Nineveh like it was in Jonah's day. They're retreating back. But as you see on the map on page 2, we took this right out of the Nahum study. And again, these things are familiar because, interestingly, I mean, you sometimes, and again, the Bible sometimes seems scattered and just random books in no particular order. But when we look at this chart, and this timeline is important in the sense that here's Isaiah's ministry right here dealing with the northern kingdom, which is still in place, the Syrians, the rising Assyrians, and the kingdom of Judah. Then northern Israel falls, Syria collapses under the weight of the Assyrians coming in, and the power is the Assyrians, and so begins Jeremiah's ministry. And Jeremiah's ministry, Zephaniah's ministry, and Habakkuk's ministry take place right here. Zephaniah's and Jeremiah's begin, or Jeremiah's begins with the Assyrians in power. Zephaniah's takes place with the total Assyrian power. And then they collapse in 612, completely, you know, the Nineveh falls. And then when Habakkuk comes, that's when Babylon is defeating the Assyrians, and we got the Babylonian kingdom. So now you've got, during this time, you're going to have the book of Daniel taking place. Then right towards the end of this map, or this diagram, this chart, you've got the book of Ezekiel. So on this chart, you can have Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Zephaniah, Habakkuk. You've got Amos back in here. You've got Hosea here. So this map covers a very important time. And the prophets then build on each other, just like, you know, we've got verses here. We already talk about the fall of Nineveh. The whole book of Nahum is about the fall of Nineveh. And so you can see things kind of becoming, I don't want to say redundant, but being repeated and being seen from Jeremiah's position, Zephaniah's position. You're going to have Habakkuk's position. So anyway, this map, the reason I say that is this map we're looking at right there. You can see how great the city was, even though they're losing territory. They are still deep into, and you can see Nineveh, how far Nineveh is. And on last week's notes, you can see it on the notes there, how deep Nineveh is into Assyrian territory, behind the Euphrates River, behind the Tigris River, with a river, and the river Kosher running right through it, and then canals coming off of it surrounding the walls, used for travel, but also used as a moat for protection. And then within the walls, you've got the important people, the elites, in their own walled section of the walled city. And so they feel secure. I mean, you can understand why. I mean, you know Bible history. You know, you have your worldview. You know Yahweh's in charge. But you can see why the people of Nineveh, it's like, no one can get to us. I mean, we may have lost some control here. We may be losing territory here. But they've still got to get all the way across the Euphrates or up the Tigris. And then when they do get here, fighting through all the fortifications, they've got to get through our walls and our water system. And then they got to get in through the walls into the palaces. So it's going to be a long time before anybody causes us to fall. But actually, when you think about it, when you go back to, well, right here, and we're going to look at this time, Ahaz was the king when Isaiah was speaking to him in 732 B.C., right around that time. And so between 732 and 612, Nineveh is going to rise and fall, or they will have dominion or influence over Judah. So what do you have right there? You've got about 120 years where the Assyrians are going to have some kind of oppression or tribute over Judah about 120 years. And this is now Zephaniah speaking within 5 years of the end. So they've been under the control of the Assyrians for 115 years. In five short years, that power over Judah is going to be broken, and that is what these verses are talking about. I would assume it was hard for the average person, the casual believer, to hear Zephaniah's words and really believe Nineveh could fall. Now, we can assume possibly Zephaniah, his words reached Nineveh or the Assyrians. It's possible because the Assyrians were in contact and had dominion over Judah. But if nothing else, the people of Judah heard these words, and these words were a source of encouragement that God was following through, that not only was God promising judgment on the surrounding cities, he's also promising judgment on Judah. That's what the book is about, judgment on Judah. These five kingdoms that are mentioned here are kind of used as examples, and they can watch one by one those kingdoms start getting picked off, falling. They've already seen the Cushites defeated by Ashurbanipal. Then you're going to see already Josiah's moving over into the banks towards the Mediterranean Sea. And Gaza is, the Philistine cities are collapsing. Moab and Ammon are having trouble. And now the collapsing Assyrian Empire. And then they're going to see the fall of Nineveh in 612. Well, that takes place. Nineveh falls in 612. And Jeremiah's prophecies begin to take place in 605 in the sense of the first captivity when Daniel's taken. So you can see right here in the heart of this, they can start seeing boom, boom, prophecies surrounding them taking place as God's moving in. And now it's time for Zephaniah's words towards Judah. And Zephaniah's not speaking alone. He's not a lone wolf out by the Jordan River like John the Baptist. He's got Jeremiah, he's got Habakkuk, and we can assume there were other prophets that were speaking, people that were on the side of Jeremiah and Habakkuk speaking these things. So, again, the people, when they would have heard this in 605, it may have been, before 612, it may have been amazing to hear, and especially as you look at the city. Now, go over to page one of the notes. I do want to look at this. I've just got this written down. I just walk through in your mind. Go to Isaiah chapter 7 and 8, and this is going to prove useful because it's, where we're at on Sunday morning when we're going through Hebrews, because these are verses that are quoted. The writer of Hebrews is going to draw from these verses. And basically what he's drawn from is that the discouragement, the hopelessness that people of God can come to. And Isaiah was in that position. Jeremiah was in that position. Habakkuk was in that position. And Jesus is going to be in that position on the cross. And he's going to quote, my God, why have you forsaken me? In the beginning of Psalm 22, halfway through, he's going to say something to the effect of, here are all the children that are with me, meaning I brought these people with me. So there's always that time in a believer's life where there's a hopelessness, but your faith gets you through. You do not understand what's going on. And this is something that really has to be embraced by believers today. There's going to come a time in your life where you really, I don't understand. And a lot of people want to say, and again, there's a truth to it, but you need to be so careful because it's really a sign. It's not biblical necessarily, because so I've been around Christians, not recently. I'm not around these people anymore, or they're not around me. I don't know. But it's like where they've got an answer for everything. Well, God, it's like you may not know theologically, you may not have any real scriptural proof, but guess what? God spoke to them, spoke in their heart what's going on. It's kind of like, really? So they're, they would say, I have the Spirit. I always know what's going on. The Spirit always reveals. It's like, well, my gosh, there was times where Zephaniah, Habakkuk, Jeremiah, Isaiah, they were confused. Even Jesus on the cross was going to say, my God, why have you forsaken me? Well, they didn't have the Spirit like I do. Well, maybe you just got some false doctrine and some great imagination, because I'm telling you, if you follow the biblical pattern, there's going to always come a time in your life where you've studied, you've lived, you've been faithful, but there's going to come that time where the veil is covering, you don't understand. You do understand, you do know God, you do have hope in Yahweh, you have faith, you have confidence, but you don't have understanding. I don't know. There comes a time where we live by faith, not by sight. And that's where, when the writer of Hebrews is going to talk about that, where it's everything's going to be confusing. But then there's going to come a time where you put your trust in God, and because of that, there's going to come a day of deliverance, a day of resurrection, a day. And that's what you see in Isaiah, is in here, you're going to have the verses where he's going to be rejected. And Isaiah is going to go through a time of rejection. Why is no one listening? But Isaiah is going to say, I put my trust in him. Actually, the verses we're looking at, and this is left over from Sunday. I didn't get to it. In chapter 8, verse 18. This is off subject a little bit, but it's kind of laying the groundwork for Sunday. And then I'm going to get back to what we're looking at in Isaiah 7 and 8. But after what takes place in chapter 7 and into chapter 8 is where Assyria is going to come and plunder Israel and eventually Judah. And Isaiah is writing all this stuff down. He's trying to explain it to the people. He's trying to say, look out, you got to get your trust in God. He's talking to Ahaz. Ahaz, as you know, in chapter 7, around 732, he became king in 735. Around 732, Pekah, the second to last king of northern Israel, Pekah is the king. And in 732, Pekah sides with the king of the Syrians, Rezin, R-E-S-I-N. They side together, and they are going to now come down and overthrow Ahaz early in his reign. And Ahaz is in a panic. He knows the Syrians and northern Israel have grouped together to come down on Judah. So Ahaz, in chapter 7, is making plans. He's going to find an ally in the Assyrians. And he's going to pay tribute to the Assyrians. If the Assyrians will come down and put some pressure on Damascus, Syria, and attack Damascus, that will take some pressure off of him. That's his plan. He's strategizing. He's playing world politics. Okay, if I can convince the Assyrians to attack the Assyrians from the north, northern Israel will have to go up there and help them. And now all of a sudden their focus is on the Assyrians and not on me. Isaiah is going to come to him in chapter 7 and says, don't do it. Don't do it. But Ahaz is going to mock Isaiah, and he's going to go ahead and send money up to the Assyrians, convince Tiglath-Pileser. Tiglath-Pileser records this also. He's going to convince Tiglath-Pileser to come down, and Damascus is going to fall. 2 Kings records in chapter 16 that when Tiglath-Pileser was in Damascus, then Ahaz hustled up, right up to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser. Thank you. And then he saw an altar there and measured it. Because we're going to do the same thing you're doing. We're going to take your culture back. And he had a priest make the Assyrian altar in Jerusalem. So Ahaz has everything under control. He's got a treaty with the Assyrians. He's selling out his country. Isaiah is saying, don't do this. Don't do this. Disaster is going to come if you do this. But Ahaz goes ahead and does it. So that is where they begin paying tribute to the Assyrians and Tiglath-Pileser. Following him is Shalmaneser, who then is going to be the one who sets Hoshea up as the puppet king, the Assyrian king. You know, we talk about being ruled by those who hate you, being ruled by a foreign country. For example, imagine a country with leadership that is doing things contrary to your culture, your laws, your constitution, your government, not in the best interest of your people, but it does benefit the people that are supporting you in power. That is Hoshea. The Assyrians put him in power, and he ruled for 10 years as a puppet king. Halfway through that time, he panicked and realized, I'm losing control of this situation, and he goes down to Egypt to pay tribute to Egypt, say, will you come help me defeat get the Assyrians? It was too late. Ahaz is going to do the same thing. He's going to pay the Assyrians to come down, and he is going to pay them money, and that money is going to become an automatic tribute every year, and Hezekiah, his son, is going to inherit that debt, that commitment. He was paying Judah, according to Ahaz's agreement, was basically paying taxes to the Assyrians to help defeat the Syrians and the northern Israel so that Ahaz could maintain his power. He was paying Judah's money up to the Assyrians so he could maintain power and be the elite. That was inherited by Hezekiah. And around 701, Hezekiah is going to say, you know what? Listening to Isaiah all across there. Isaiah spoke to Ahaz. He didn't listen. He spoke to Hezekiah. He did listen. He spoke to Manasseh. He didn't listen and eventually killed Isaiah. So Isaiah speaks to all three of these kings. In 701, Hezekiah has been listening to Isaiah and he decides, okay, we're not going to pay tribute. We're breaking this treaty. We're going to take care of Judah first. You know, make Judah great again is what the hat said. And Hezekiah was listening to Isaiah at that time. And that's when Sennacherib came down. And when you want to make Judah great again, it's not an easy task because Sennacherib came down and destroyed and attacked all the fortified cities. Azekah, Lachish, Hebron, all the fortified cities were destroyed, just marched right through them. And as he had done all the way across the map, there's only one city left standing, as you know, that was Jerusalem in 701. And he even sent his field marshal over and threatened Jerusalem. And it's at that time that Sennacherib's army, they had 185,000 soldiers died. The Greeks record this. Josephus records it. The Bible records it two places. And Sennacherib then, after the Battle of Lachish, as you know, retreats back to Nineveh, builds a huge palace. You can see it marked right here on this map where his palace was at on this map. And in his palace room, with the walls were paneled in stone carvings, and these are some of them right here, of his battle at Lachish. You can see the whole battle take place. You can just walk around, all the details going all the way around, with him sitting on the throne and Judah's prisoners being brought before him and their leaders being brought before him, people on stakes down here, people being flayed alive, like right here, surrounding himself with his last battle in Judah, because the next thing that happens is he challenges Jerusalem. Isaiah and Hezekiah pray, the Lord speaks, and 185,000 soldiers die. And if you believe in the Bible account or Herodotus' account, or Josephus' account, that's your own choice. But historically, Sennacherib goes back to Nineveh, builds his palace, surrounds himself with carvings of his last battle, and never goes to Judah again, never goes south again, never goes down there again, and never attacks Jerusalem. He defeated every city in Judah, all the way down to Judah, every city in Judah that had a fortified stronghold, and he got to Jerusalem and decided, I'm not even going to attack. And he records, but I made Hezekiah continue to pay me tribute. And Hezekiah then continued to send tribute up because his father had committed to the Assyrians. And then comes Manasseh. Manasseh, as you know, tries to go with the Babylonians possibly and try to overthrow the Assyrians. He has trouble. Then comes Ammon and then Josiah. But nonetheless, chapter 8, Isaiah is talking in Isaiah chapter 8, telling the people, telling the king what's going on. He's explaining to them what is going on, and no one listens. And we'll read some more of this later. But in verse 16, I'll just read this whole thing. Yeah, start in verse 11, chapter 8, verse 11. The Lord spoke to me with his strong hand upon me, warning me not to follow the way of this people. In context, this people is right here, 732. It's right when the Assyrians or the Judah is going to go to the Assyrians for help. They're trying to figure out how to work the world powers to their advantage. He says, do not follow the way of this people. Now, you're going to love this next verse. He said to Isaiah, do not call conspiracy everything these people call conspiracy. This is a conspiracy. That's a conspiracy. It's like, no, this is not a conspiracy. They think it's a conspiracy. It's not a conspiracy. This is the stinking truth. This is the reality. Now, I'm not talking about today. You make your own decision about what's going on today. I'm talking about 732 when Ahaz was trying to buy power and sell the kingdom of Judah to the Assyrians so he could maintain his elite power and not be taken out by northern Israel and the Syrians and have himself replaced. He wanted to protect his throne. And to protect his throne, he took money out of Judah, out of the temple, and took it up to the Assyrians and says, please help me maintain my power in my country. I'll take money from the people and give it to you. Do not call conspiracy everything these people call conspiracy. Do not fear what they fear, and do not dread it. The Lord Almighty is the one you are to regard as holy. He is the one you are to fear. He is the one you are to dread. So you had this tension between, should we side with this political party or this political party? Are we going to go with Ahaz and support this? And Isaiah splitting the thing right down the middle. It's like there's all kinds of conspiracies and theories, and everybody's got their own agenda trying to figure out what's going on. And there is conspiracy going on. I mean, it's not even a conspiracy. It's just a flat-out truth. Ahaz is selling out his country to the Assyrians so he can maintain power. He's even going up to measure the altar and bring it down into Jerusalem. I think he's trying to bring Assyrian religion here. Well, yeah, he is. He just brought their altar down here. He wants to be like the Assyrians. Isaiah says, don't worry about this. The Lord, you got to focus on the Lord. He is the one you are to dread, and he will be a sanctuary. You fear him, he will be your sanctuary. He will be the one that will protect you. But for both houses of Israel, he will be a stone that causes men to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. In other words, Isaiah is talking to his disciples. You fear the Lord. Don't follow Israel. Don't follow Judah. Don't follow the conspiracy theories of going on. You follow the Lord. Fear him, and he will be your sanctuary. He's telling him, save your soul. He says, but for both houses of Israel, if it be both political parties, if it be the northern Israel or southern Judah, this Lord, this is going to become a stone that causes men to stumble. They will not be able to, they don't have faith. They're going to just stumble on this stone. It's a rock that makes them fall. Here's the truth. The only thing they can do on the truth is trip on it. And for the people of Jerusalem, he will be a trap and a snare. So the Lord, who's trying to bring them deliverance because they reject it, he actually then becomes the trap, a snare. They trip on the answer because they reject the answer. Many of them will stumble, they will fall and be broken, and they will be snared and captured. But now in verse 16, that's his message. I mean, it's almost like he's wrapping it up right here as far as his message to this people. And then he says, bind up the testimony and seal up the law among my disciples. And what he's saying is, okay, that's what's going on. Don't call everything these conspiracies. This is just a flat-out truth. He's selling out the nation. You can't trust Judah. You can't trust the kings of Israel. They're all deceiving you, using you. You're in the final days. What you need to do is fear the Lord, and he'll be a sanctuary. But the same Lord is going to be a trap, a stumbling stone. They're going to fall on it's going to fall on them for the house of Israel, for the house of Judah, and the people of Jerusalem are going to be fall into this trap. That's the answer. Does anybody understand it? And the culture, the kings looked at him and go, no, we don't. We disagree with that totally. And here it is. So he says, bind up the testimony. What testimony? The thing he just said. The thing he just testified to. And seal up the law among my disciples. Okay, everything I've just told you, roll it up. I'm done here. Roll this stuff up. Tie it off. Seal it. And we have found an Isaiah bulla, which is a seal that was pressed with Isaiah's ring. It's almost 100%. There's only one letter missing. It says Isaiah the prophet, if you translate it in English. The P is missing. Otherwise, Isaiah the prophet. or Isaiah the prophet. Again, it doesn't say that. It says it in Hebrew. But it's just that first letter. And there's only one letter that could part of the letter is there. And there's only one possible letter would even make a word. So it says Isaiah the prophet. And it was found a few feet away from one of the seals of Hezekiah. In other words, it was what it is from the remains of scrolls, documents, communications that were burnt in the Babylonian fires in Judah. And the only thing that remained was the clay seal that sealed the document. The documents all burned. And so they found a bunch of these. And within they found several Hezekiah bula or bule. But a lot of them were popped up in different places, black markets and stuff. They don't know where they were found. But they found a scientific excavation just like 24 months ago, 36 months ago. They found an Isaiah seal and a bula, and a few feet later in the same complex, they found Hezekiah's. Same layer, same age. So, I mean, these guys were in communication with each other. We've got their, it's almost like their signature that's left over. So what he's saying, again, I'm not saying the documents that he's referring to here were sealed, but when he says seal or bind up the testimony and seal up the law among my disciples, he's talking about rolling up the scrolls, everything he's got written down. He got all written down. Put a drop of clay on there, seal them up, put it away. Seal it up, put it away. Put in the files. I'm done. Put these away. Seal it up. And he gives it to his disciples. He says, or his followers, because Isaiah would have had students who kept his documents, kept his teaching alive. He wasn't a lone wolf all by himself. Neither was John the Baptist a lone wolf all by himself. John the Baptist had disciples. As you know, he even had disciples in Ephesus. When Paul gets to Ephesus, guess what he meets on the outside of Ephesus? Followers of John the Baptist. It's like, what the heck? He was out in the wilderness. So he had followers all around. So he had disciples. But he says, bind up the testimony and seal up the law among my disciples. In other words, no one's listening. We're done here. Just give it to my disciples. Put it away. No one understands it. And watch this. And then he says in verse 17, this is the hopeless state. I will wait for the Lord, who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. I will put my trust in him. It's like, you're not listening? Okay. The reason you're not listening is God is judging you. You are being judged by God. You don't even know it. The God of Judah is hiding his face from the house of Judah. How do I know? Because you can't understand anything I'm saying. And so God is hiding his face from you. So we've said everything. I've explained everything. Seal it up. Give it to my disciples. Put it away. It says, I will wait for the Lord. Isaiah said, I'll wait for the Lord. Someday in the future, this will all make sense. Right now, it doesn't make sense. You can't hear it. You're too full of conspiracies here. Are we with Isaiah or Israel? Are we with Ahaz? Are we with the Assyrians? Who are we with? It's like, you should be with the Lord, but you're not. So you're going to trip and stumble and fall and be crushed by this whole series of events. So seal up the documents, put them away. I'll wait for the Lord, who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob right now. I will put my trust in him. Now, that's we're going to talk about that on Sunday. That's my God, why have you forsaken me? That's the part of what's going on. And then here comes the part right here. He says, here am I and the children the Lord has given me. I will stand here. I will live my life out. Me and the children the Lord has given me will live our lives out. We are signs and symbols in Israel from the Lord Almighty who dwells on Mount Zion. You're not going to read the scrolls. You're not going to pay attention to the teaching. Bind them up. But I'm not leaving. I'm going to stay right here and live my life. My children and I are going to live right in front of you. That would include his disciples. And we're going to live as testimonies. And you're going to have to watch us during this whole disaster. Watch how we go through this whole thing. And that's where it goes right there. Now, that is, again, that phrase right there that's very important. Two things are going to be important in Hebrews is, I will put my trust in him in a state of hopelessness. No one understands. God is hiding his face. He's bringing judgment, but I'm still going to trust the Lord. And then, here am I, and the children of the Lord has given me. We're going to come out on the other end. And that's going to be the same thing that Jesus is going to go to the cross, and on the other side of the cross is going to be the children or the brothers that are with him. It's like, what is happening? I'm not sure. Just go through it. And he was the pioneer that's going to take him through. We'll talk about that. Now, that's chapter 8. That's the way chapter 8 ends. Chapter 8 is connected to chapter 7. And now in chapter 7, verse 1, what's taking place in 732 is right here. We're talking about this because this is where Israel and Assyria began to interact. Right here in Ahaz's day, it's going to be about 120 years between Ahaz and the fall of Nineveh in 612. And this is where it begins. When Ahaz, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. So there was a battle. This king, Pekah, and Rezin, the king of Syria, marched down in the early days of Ahaz's reign to fight, and they couldn't overpower him. Now the house of David was told, Aram has allied itself with Ephraim, or the Syrians have allied themselves with northern Israel, Ephraim. So the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken. So Ahaz and all of his people in Jerusalem, they're afraid, they're shaken, as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind. Okay, that's Isaiah's state right here. That's when he begins to step out and help Ahaz. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son, Shir Jashub. And again, Shir Jashub means, let me see what it says here. Okay, yeah, Shir Jashub. You can see it in your footnotes, right? A remnant will return. There's two sons. One son's name means a remnant will return, meaning we're going to go through some dark days, but there's going to be deliverance. On the Abrahamic covenant is going to show up on the other side. He's got a son with him that's telling him, we may go through some dark times, but a remnant will return. He's going to have another son that's going to be addressed in chapter 8 at the beginning. You see chapter 8, verse 1, Maher Shalah Hashbez. He goes out to Ahaz with the son. The remnant will return. The remnant will return. That's the son. Because he's rejected, he's going to have another son. He's going to name him, again, this name, as you can see in chapter 8, verse 1, Maher Shalah Hashbez, which means, and he's going to have it documented by the priest before the son is born, what his name means. And his name means quick to the plunder, quick to the spoil, which means we're going to get plundered. We're going to get rolled over. So the first one, the remnant's going to return. There's hope. Okay, you rejected it. Well, guess what? You're going to get rolled over. You're going to get plundered. So anyway, he goes out and meet Ahaz. Go out. The Lord said, Yahweh said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son, Shir of Jashub, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool. That's probably up on a pool up north by the church of the Holy Sepulchre, right below the Petra Hotel, right off David Road in the northern quarter. On the road of the washerman's field, say to him, be careful. This is Ahaz's words, or Isaiah's words to Ahaz in 732. Be careful. Keep calm. Don't be afraid. Do not lose heart because of these two smoldering stubs of firewood, Pekah and Rezin. They're nobodies. Don't worry about them. Because these two smoldering stubs of firewood, because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and the son of Remaliah. Aram, Ephraim, and Remaliah's son have plotted your ruin, saying, let us invade Judah, let us tear it apart and divide it amongst ourselves, and make the son of Tabeel king over it. This is not a conspiracy. This is the fact. It's like, do you think there's a conspiracy? No, it's not a conspiracy. This is a fact, or however you want to read it. Is this a fact or it's a conspiracy? Whatever. They plotted against you. This is the hardcore evidence. These two kings are coming against you, and they've got this guy over here ready to take your throne. But guess what? It's not going to happen. You don't need to worry about the conspiracy. You don't need to worry. Is it true? Is it false? It doesn't matter if it's true. It's not going to happen. It doesn't matter if it's false. It's not going to happen because the Lord is going to be your strength. The Lord is going to take care of it. Yet this is what the sovereign Lord says. It will not take place. It will not happen. For the head of Aram is Damascus. The head of Damascus is only Rezin, meaning they don't have any covenant. They're nothing. They're just passing in the wind. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be too shattered to be a people, meaning they're collapsing. They're in the final cycles of discipline. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is only Remaliah's son. And who's Remaliah's son? No, he's not like the son of David. He's the son of Remaliah. Who's Remaliah? I don't know. Where'd he come from? I don't know. He's not. The head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. The head of Samaria, or Samaria is the head of, it's like there's nothing here. They're under judgment. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. Now, if you're going to continue to deal in these conspiracy theories, who's against who, whose side am I on, what's the truth? It's like, you're not going to stand at all. You've got to trust. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you won't stand at all. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz through Isaiah. Ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest heights or deepest depths or the highest heights. But Ahaz said, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. That's not a statement of honor. It's like, I'm not going to ask. I'm not going to play some game with your God. I'm not going to put your God to the test. Let him prove that he's right. Boo. You made a prophecy. I'm not going to do it. Get out of here, Isaiah. Now watch this. There's two things happening here. He's talking to Ahaz, but he's also talking to the throne of David. So there's a man, and the man is on a throne that represents the line of David. And this was pointed out to me, someone pointed this out to in an email and showed me the Hebrew in this, and I didn't realize this. It goes from singular to plural right in here. In one case, he's talking to Ahaz, and then he steps back and announces and makes an announcement to the entire line of David. Isaiah said, hear now, you house of David. Before, again the Lord spoke, in verse 10, again the Lord spoke to Ahaz. Ask the Lord for a sign. And the man Ahaz, representing the rebellious throne of David, again, this is going to be cut off. This rebellious throne of David is going to be cut off with the death of Zedekiah. That is the end. There's no or Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, Zedekiah. They'll never sit on the throne of David again. That's a prophecy given by Jeremiah. They're going to be cut off. And right here, so he asked Ahaz to give him a sign. Ask for a sign, and Ahaz rejects it. I'm not going to let your God do some kind of magic trick. I'm not going to ask him for any sign. And you can tell it's like, well, he was just being a good, faithful. I'm not going to put your Lord to the test. Well, you can tell God wanted to show him. He wanted to prove, because then Isaiah said, hear now you, here it goes plural, house of David. Is it not enough to try the patience of men? Meaning, you've been beating and beating and beating and rejecting Isaiah. You're trying. He keeps trying to help you. You're testing Isaiah, the patience of man. And he keeps coming here and trying to help. Will you try the patience of my God also? You've been trying Isaiah, and now you're mocking his God who's speaking to you? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel, God with us. Now, what takes place here is there's going to be two children going to be born. There's going to be the son born in chapter 8, verse 1. The Mahershala Hasbaz, which is going to be a sign for Ahaz, because that son is going to mean quick to the plunder, quick to the spoil. It means you're going to be rolled over, and it's going to happen by this time. Within 12 years, all these things are going to start taking place. And this sign right here, this Emmanuel, is a sign to the house of David. The virgin will be the child. And this is where, if your line gets cut off, it's going to pick up right here again. The virgin will be with child and give birth to a son. You will call him Emmanuel. He will eat curds. He goes through and talks about that. And we all this, you can see here more talking about the Assyrians and being told what to do with that. Nonetheless, this is what's taking place right here with the beginning of the rise of Tiglath-Pileser with Israel, and then Ahaz going up to meet him, and they start paying tribute to him. And now this whole time, this from Ahaz all the way up to Zephaniah, right up here, they're going to be sending money to the Assyrians. Sometime here, Hezekiah tried to stop. Manasseh tried to do something if they're going to join a revolt. Josiah is finding that with the decline of Assyria, halfway through Ashurbanipal's reign, they're declining, and he's becoming weak. And these guys are just puppet kings here. Not puppet kings, but very, very weak kings. Josiah is now expanding the territory. So, you know, they probably weren't sending money to the Assyrians during this time because the Assyrians are just in retreat. But that sets the stage, and that's kind of what is written right there, setting up the stage for what is looking at in Nineveh. Now, let's go back to the page one of the notes. Now, this is what Zephaniah, right here, is saying. Again, 624 to 617. So you can see if this began in 632, you got 120 years, and now Zephaniah is making this pronouncement, and the Lord is now speaking to the Assyrians, and this will take place in 612. We already know this because we studied the book of Nahum. But it's the same thing. Nahum has already said this. Zephaniah is, I'm sure it's his own prophecy, but it's already been spoken by the Lord through Nahum. Maybe spoken directly to Nineveh by Nahum. But chapter 2, verse 13, and he will stretch out his hand, that's Yahweh, will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria. And it's actually already begun. It's already begun. And he will make, watch this, he will make Nineveh a desolation, a dry waste like a desert. Now again, Nineveh, if you go back and look at that map, think of these two words, desolation, a dry waste like a desert. If you look at the map on page 2, you can see how ridiculous that would sound in 612. Because you've got Nineveh, including the palace of Sennacherib's palace, you've got a river, Kosher, running right through the city. In fact, Sennacherib's palace is just like right outside, right by the river. It's just right outside the river. And that's surrounded by a canal where the water peels off, or an irrigation system, and that feeds directly into the Tigris River. So they were known for, in fact, archaeology and history. We talk about the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's Hanging Gardens. And I've read just a little bit about this. I haven't spent a lot of time researching it. But you've heard about the Hanging Gardens of Nebuchadnezzar or of Babylon. What scholars are saying now and archaeologists say now is if you look at the images and the carvings, those images, that legend got transferred to Babylon. But it was actually Nineveh. Because you can see the layers of on images, you can see the arches and the layers and the trees all going up with water running down images. And so the Hanging Gardens of Babylon may actually have originally been the Hanging Gardens of Nineveh. That when Babylon conquered, the story just got transferred down. Now, then again, that's one of the teachings. But nonetheless, if it's not the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, they had water. They had running water, you know, coming up, going up, and then running down through the trees and all around the palace. And now, this pronouncement right here, dry waste like a desert, is like, I mean, it's really a stretch. It's really a stretch to even, how can you even think that this city, which sits on a river, is surrounded by a river, and sits on the Tigris River, would be dry like a desert? And you can see I've got that written down there. But again, that takes place, and we've got a Greek general marching by. We've talked about this. We went through Nahum in 401 BC. Xenophon, the Greek general, records as he traveled past Nineveh that it had become desert sand. It wasn't that it just disappeared. It's like Egypt, where the sand just blows over and covers it up. The Greeks marched through the Middle East to take the Persian Empire. The city of Nineveh could no longer even be identified, and culture was itself ancient history. It did not find a trace, or he, when he went by, did not find a trace of the city since it was buried in sand. In other words, like we talked about in Nahum, the Greek army, as they're going past Nineveh, they couldn't find it because they marched right over the top of it because it was buried in sand. And that's when these guys found these monuments here. Again, we're going back to Nahum. All these things were found, and they weren't like standing there like pyramids. They excavated, and all of a sudden they're like, what's this? They began to ask, oh my gosh, we found the city of Nineveh. And like I said, when we did Nahum, the archaeologist said, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, he says, if we had not found this to show you these things, all those legends about Nineveh would have merely remained legends and no one would have believed them. But these legends now were not legends because this is what we found. And they've excavated Sennacherib's palace and stuff. So nonetheless, that prophecy came to pass and is still, in a sense, in place today. Now, the next verse, chapter 2, verse 14 on bottom of page 2, there's a lot of words here. Basically, the ideal is that animals are going to take over the place. And we'll look at some of the words. Herds shall lie down in her midst, all kinds of beasts. So you're going to have herds, you know, if it be cattle, if it be sheep, if they're grazing, they're going to be out here in the wilderness, and the herds, and depends on how you translate it, and I've got the Hebrew there, herds are going to come by and they're going to lay down. It doesn't use the word graze, but they're laying down. It must be some kind of food source there, you know, but they're going to lay down there, and just herds, shepherds. And then now the other in the English, herds and all kinds of beasts, herds and beasts. And these beasts are, again, they're tied in with locusts in Joel. So all kinds of herds, beasts. In other words, it's even Calvin in his writings, he says, we're not going to spend time trying to decide what they're talking about. The essence is there. And again, I like to go through and get the details. But he was satisfied with just whatever you want to call it. It's wild animals are living over the top of Nineveh. And then it goes on in the English Standard Version, even the owl and the hedgehog, owl and hedgehog, it says, shall lodge in her capitals. Now, the capitals would be the pillars and then the tops of the capitals that are still standing or sticking up out of the ground. Maybe they're mostly buried, but the capitals, the owls will sit on them. The hedgehog will sit on them. They're just, you know, they used to be, the point is, this used to be the place of luxury. This used to be the place of well-protected. This was the cutting edge of technology. This is the crown of education. This was the best of man's, you know, where the best of men lived. Now owls land there, and just head. They're living in what was at one time the high value property, the sought out property. Animals are living there. And again, you just reflect on your own culture, reflect on your own house. You know, all the things that are valuable. It's a moment in time, because it's just going to take a few years, whatever it is, if it's 50, if it's 200, it's whatever property that we have. It's just a matter of time before nature revolves around and reconquers it, and animals are grazing, and you know, and animals are living in the remains. A voice shall hoot from the window, it says. Sounds like an owl. Devastation shall be on the threshold. The threshold, of course, is where you walk in the door. And so the threshold where you'd walk in, that's collapsed down. So instead of a threshold where you could walk the doorway, that's collapsed down. And so devastation is on the threshold, meaning, you know, our buildings collapse. And for her cedar work will be laid bare. The cedar work is the wood. Now, again, It took me a while to understand this, because you look at ancient remains, ancient houses, ancient buildings, and you see, you know, the stones, and you just got to like spend some time and look at some artist renditions and imagine what it would be like. Because remember, when David built a palace or Solomon built the temple, they brought cedars from Lebanon down and they paneled the temple. And remember, the temple burnt when the Babylonians or the Romans set it on fire. It burnt. And sometimes, you know, you get this image, at least, again, I'm speaking to my own self. I have this mind that it was they made block. You know, they cut stone. We saw the quarries where they took the stones out, and we saw the Herodian stones in other places. So we know the stones that they built. And the outside, they talk about it, was like white marble. It was like glistening when the sun shone on it. Josephus records how white the temple was. But when you get on the inside, it was also block or, you know, carved stone. But then they would overlay that with paneling. Just like, you know, like our houses, you know, my house is 2x4s, but it's over the 2x4s is sheetrock. And then we paint the sheetrock and we decorate it, trim it out, even put some oak and, you know, some wood up. Well, that's the same thing here. They didn't live in rock palaces or stone palaces. They would have used stone, but then to finish it off, they would have decorated the stone or they would have put paneling and then carved it. And even the stone would have been painted. So the high, like when you talk about these paintings here, they just live in the black and white world of just all these stone carvings. Well, no, this would have all been detailed. You know, the wheels would have been colored, the spokes would have been a different color, the horse would have been the color of a horse. You would have had, you know, all the armor would have been decorated, just like the Greek statues. You know this, all those Greek, you know, the white Greek statues, the marble statues. It's like, and we've talked about it before, they weren't just white statues. They would have their eyes painted. In fact, that's why they got like these balls for eyes. Like, wow, that's a creepy statue. Well, they would have painted all the details of the eye, you know, the hair, everything would have been painted. The garments would have been painted. They had a sash going across that would have been painted. So all these things were painted. The point here, for her cedar work will be laid bare, it says in English Standard. That means right here, all that wood is going to decay, and what's behind it is going to be exposed. It's like all your sheetrock is going to decay, and you're just going to have the studs remaining, except in our case, the studs will decay also. I mean, you imagine what's going to be left of my house when they excavate it. It's going to be a basement slab, you know. It's just, because it's not even really a basement. It's just, you know, it's like the walls are gone, the roof is gone. It's going to be like a slab of concrete, and they'll never find it. And that's what I got written down here. If you look in the, just for the fun of it, look in verse or page 3, and you're going to see the Hebrew transliteration. And what I've got written down there talks about herds and beasts. Point 2, the great buildings and paneled palaces would become a place for wild animals to find shelter. The owl could also be translated pelican. The hedgehog could also be translated porcupine. They're lodging on the capitals. The owls are hooting from the windows' ledges. So where the window used to be, there's an owl hooting there. And I'll just read through this, the Hebrew text on the top of page 3. You've got to read it backwards. And shall lie down in her midst the herds, every beast of the nations, or every beast of the nation, both the pelican and the bittern. On the capitals of her pillars. When it says capitals, it refers to on top of the pillars. Now, is the pillars high? They might be with the capitals on top. Or, just like they found statues, in Egypt, well, first thing they found was the top of the head because it was buried. And then they had to, like, carve it out and dig all the way down because the whole statue itself was still standing, but it had been buried. So these capitals may be buried in the sand, and they're just the only thing sticking up out of the ground is the cap, or the pillars are buried, the capitals on top, either way. It says, the bitten on her cap, on the capitals of her pillars shall lodge. Their voice shall sing in the windows. Desolation shall be at the threshold. And again, the desolation, I think that's the collapsing of the building down. Because you're going to have some kind of a header on top of the door. And when that gives way, that breaks, that whole wall collapses. For the cedar work he will lay bare. Again, everything's going to be exposed because the cedar work is gone. So that is, again, what that verse is saying. Basically, the glory is going to be gone. And that continues in chapter 2, verse 15, the bottom of page 3. This is the exultant city that lived securely, that said in her heart, I am and there is no one else. Now, first of all, let's look at this. This is the exultant city. If you look on the page 4, exultant, it means jubilant or the triumphantly happy. This is the triumphantly happy city. Again, this Nineveh, all the city, Jerusalem, Judah, was paying tribute for 100 and some years, was sending, in fact, Hezekiah had to strip the gold off the doors of the temple to send it to Nineveh, just because they're running out of money. And Assyria's saying, well, we're going to need more. They're going to continue to raise taxes. What are you going to do? Say, no, we're going to find another sponsor. I mean, you got to pay it. And so they've got all of Judah's gold, but not only Judah's, they've conquered Egypt in 663. So Egypt is sending gold. They conquered everything from Syria all the way down through northern Israel, the Philistines, everyone's fan. And that's just on the west. They also conquered to the south and to the east, and everybody's sending them gold, a tribute. And so when it says the exultant city, or it would be translated, the exultant or the jubilant or the triumphantly happy. I mean, they're just, it's like people just keep sending us stuff. This is the triumphant city that lived securely. And again, securely because look how far up they are. We talked about that. They got walls, they got water, they've got distance separating them from their enemies. They got military surrounding, they got fortifications going all the way up and down the rivers and stretched across the frontier. They've got, people are sending them gold. There's no way Nineveh's going to, it's the eternal city. It's going to be there forever. And you can understand why they would. You would think that if you lived there, you wouldn't be like, well, someday everything falls, but it's not going to be in our lifetime. Well, Zephaniah is saying, yeah, it's going to be in about 5 years. After judgment, desolation, it means waste, a lair for wild beasts, a place for beasts to lie down. Reading on, I'm going to go back to the text. It says, what a desolation she has become, a lair or a place for wild beasts to lie down. Everyone who passes by her hisses and shakes his fist. So people that pass by, if it be travelers, if it be people out walk, you know, going to their next destination, if they're shepherds or whatever they're doing, to say that, it means people pass by, it means to scorn the remains. And we see this in Nahum. I've got it written down there, page 4, under point 2. Nahum 3:19 has another hand gesture. Here in Zephaniah it says, they shake their fist. But in Nahum it says, all who hear the news about you clap their hands over you, upon whom has not come your unceasing evil. Again, the taking of tribute and the plundering of all these cities. So they're clapping their hands, just like we would clap our hands rejoicing, or shaking their fist is some kind of indication of scorn or contempt, meaning it's basically like, you know, just curse this place. You know, no one liked this place. I mean, no one's going to remember, no one's going to have fond memories of Nineveh, because in the people that can remember Nineveh just remember the stories of their oppression. And then the last thing we've got there, point 3 on page 4, where they say, I am and there is no one else. I think we're talking about two things. They're self-sufficient, and they are. I mean, they want it, they get it. They can create whatever they want to create. But also, there is no other. There's no one else. There's no one else that has control of the economy like they've got control of the economy. There's no one else that determines culture like they determine culture. If Nineveh wears it, the princes, we know this already in the book, if Nineveh's wearing it, the sons of the king want to wear it. Ahaz, if Tiglath-Pileser has an altar, the king of Judah takes a tape measure up and measures it and has someone write down the details so he can have one too in Judah. So that one, there is no other. We are the ones that establish the economy, the protection, the military, the culture, the morals. There's no other. We establish right and wrong. We are the people. Same way you can see, and if you go to chapter 47 of Isaiah, 47, yeah, is it 47 of Isaiah? Yeah, 47 Isaiah. I'm just going to flip there. You can if you want to. I didn't write it down. Isaiah 47, you can hear this being spoken of Babylon. 47 verse 8, chapter 47 verse 8. This is Isaiah speaking to Babylon. Again, if we're talking about Babylon that fell to the Persians, or Babylon the Great in Revelation. And there is obviously an overlap just because of they're all falling. If it be Nineveh, Babylon of the past, of Babylon of the future. Chapter 47, verse 8 of Isaiah. Now then, listen, you wanton creature, lounging in your security. Okay, that's Babylon, but that's Nineveh, lounging in their security. And we've got images here of the kings somewhere here, especially Ashurbanipal, just lounging and having grapes fed to them. Just, you know, they conquered everything. What else is to do except enjoy everything? Lounging in your security and saying to yourself, and watch this line right here, I am and there is none besides me. That's what Isaiah said back here about Babylon. Now, Zephaniah is saying that about Nineveh. And here's what they go on to say, I will never be a widow or suffer the loss of children. Both of these, God says, will overtake you in a moment, on a single day, loss of children and widowhood. They will come upon you in full measure in spite of your many sorceries and all of your potent spells. You have trusted in your wickedness and have said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and knowledge mislead you. When you say to yourself, I am, and there is none besides me. I am self-sufficient, and there is no one else that establishes right and wrong, the economy, culture, other than me. I am self-sufficient, and I establish reality. You are misled. You've deceived yourself. You've misled yourself. Disaster will come upon you, and you will not know how to conjure it away. And he goes on and talks about that there, and that's Babylon. So anyway, that's the end of Nineveh. What's interesting, again, we see it repeated in Jeremiah. We see it repeated in Zephaniah. We've already heard it from Nahum. So that is just laying down. Next week, we continue into chapter 3, and there we return to Jerusalem. After they've been told all about the falls of the nations around them, now they come back. And again, it's not a call to repentance. It's a pronouncement of judgment that is coming with a promise that, oh yeah, although you're going to be judged, this doesn't nullify the Abrahamic covenant. There will be a restoration in the distant future. And you notice what's missing with the Philistines and Moab and Ammon and Egypt or Cush and the Assyrians. There's no recovery. It's like, but someday I will restore Nineveh. No, Assyria's gone. Jacob I've loved, Esau and all the other Gentile nations I've hated. I have no covenant. In fact, at the end of the Philistines and Moab and Ammon, what we do see is a promise to Judah. It's like, your territory is going to be restored to you. I'm going to give you the territory. Not to the Philistines. They've got it for a temporary time. Now we're going to destroy them. But when I restore the fortunes of Judah, I'll bring you back to this land too. When I restore the fortunes of Israel, Moab and Ammon will be occupied by the survivors that return from Israel. So again, there's no promise to the Philistines, Moab, Ammon, Cush, the Assyrians. But there is a promise, and that's going to come out here at the end of chapter 3 for the people of Judah. Although Zephaniah is not done telling them judgment is coming. I'll pray, and next week we'll continue with chapter 3. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for your truth. We ask again that we would allow these words to speak to us, that we would find a chance to strengthen our own heart and place trust in you, and not look at some answer in the world, but Father, that we would look to answers for you, that we would trust you in our times of need, in our times of distress. And Father, we do want to have a hope that endures all the persecution, all the hardships that we might have to face. We ask that your Spirit would quicken our hearts and bring this word to life in our lives. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.